Welcome to Nil. I'm Quentin Irie.
And I'm James King.
This is the show for people that are just starting out in the world, just figuring stuff out like us. Each episode, one of us will bring a topic. The other person does not know what that topic is. It's pulled from our lives, and we'll explore that and any tangential issues that come up along the way. We're still figuring out what this is, but I'm sure it'll get more and more specific as we go. So join us for that journey. This episode, James, you have our topic, so I have a notebook ready, and hopefully what I come up with on the fly is not complete garbage.
And tangential, first of all, is a great word. I don't think I've heard that before, but I like it.
I try.
All right, so this is inspired actually by a recent event in my life, and I think I snapped you about it the night after it happened. And I'm going to be very careful in the way that I explain this because I don't want to get ahead of myself here in terms of how many people are actually going to listen to this or if the people that I'm talking about are going to listen to this. So I'm just going to play it safe and be careful about how I'm explaining this and obviously avoid mentioning any names. But basically what had happened was, and it's something, I don't know if you've experienced this kind of in your own social interactions, but kind of like you introduce someone new to a pre-existing friend group, right? So people you've known for a while. In this case, I've known these folks for well over 10 years. But introduce someone new, and then they break off and start kind of doing their own thing and sort of exclude you from that new friend that you introduced them to. So basically, like you're now not in the circle anymore. And that hasn't happened to me a whole bunch, but I was just reminded of how much that sucks. Basically, it's not a pleasant experience, obviously, when your pre-existing friends or people you thought were your friends kind of start hanging out with the new person you introduced them to. But bottom line is, we don't like getting left out. It's not fun being left out of an interaction or a circle or friend group. But really, the question that I was asking myself is it really inherently bad to be left out? Is it a bad thing to not be friends with everyone? And really, just following that train of thought, which is better from a psychological standpoint, more friends or closer friends? Which to me, they're mutually exclusive. So you can't have a lot. You either can have a lot of friends or you can have a few close friends, but you can't have a lot of close friends. Just because of the nature of how that works. So I have a quote. It's from Seneca, the philosopher. And he says, when a person spends all of their time in foreign travel, they end up having acquaintances but no friends. And the same must hold true of people who seek intimate acquaintances with no single author but visit them all in a hasty and hurried manner. So really, what's clear here is that those are viewed as anti-correlated, right? More friends or closer friends. So in an article called Which is Better, More Friends or Closer Friends, there is a student at UCLA at Harvard, Cody Commerce, who did some research into the cognitive science of this. He kind of came to the same conclusion, right, that having acquaintances and close friends is anti-correlated. So now, of course, there are other people on the other side of this school of thought, other side of the coin, that would support the idea that you would want essentially more arm length connections. So basically you widen the net and you have more friends. And so eventually when people let you down, you have more people to kind of offset that, I guess. So there are people kind of on both sides. There are people that say make those close friendships with a few folks. And there are other people that say basically take a more economical approach, I guess, and kind of diversify, right? And have a bunch of shallow connections, as it were, that you can deepen maybe later if you need to. Basically, the more friends you have, you don't really have to rely on any one of them. So when you lose one, it's not a huge deal. So to me, that side of the coin and that school of thought doesn't sound very rewarding to me. And especially, you know, in the past couple of years, just everything that, you know, I've gone through, my family's gone through, it really has been a lot more important to me to have those few close friends that I can really count on, that I really know, than having just a bunch of people that, you know, you know them at a glance, but you don't really know much about them. The next article here is kind of interesting as well. This kind of goes into the psychology of why we do this. So basically the science behind why we keep our friend circle small. And this is by Christine Rivas. I don't want to say her last name. And I might have cited this source before. I don't remember. But I kind of, every time I do this new research, I kind of try to find some new kind of interesting source. This one is called Rebel Circus. It's a web-based alternative fashion retailer located in New York City. The bio kind of cracked me up. Inspired by a new generation of consumers and trendsetters who rebel against the everyday norm and fashions found at the local shopping mall, which to me is very specific. So this is kind of interesting. Is this it's really a fashion source, but they're kind of approaching this from a, this particular author here is more of a, is a, I think a psychologist or a psychotherapist, but she has a couple of different theories. So friendship can vary depending on where you're from. And what I mean more specifically by this are regional conditions. So for instance, in America, we put a lot of value in online connections. So those are very important to have those online friendships. We view those as very important. The amount of followers we have, the amount of connections we have on Twitter, Instagram, whatever it may be. But the fact is that that actually isn't valued everywhere. And we kind of forget that sometimes, that in the rest of the world, not a lot of emphasis is necessarily put on that. Not addressing from a business standpoint, but from purely a personal standpoint, a lot of nations and a lot of people don't really view that as having friends. If you said you had 300, 400 followers online that you had never met, a lot of places wouldn't even consider those friends. Whereas in America, we might consider those at least acquaintances or people that we have, quote, met online. But what's interesting is that definition does not carry regionally. It doesn't carry culturally. Like that's not what people would necessarily view as a friend in places other than America. And the second that she was talking about in this article were economic conditions. And that was the one that kind of resonated with me because I've noticed this with a huge job switch that I made, right? Or I guess going from employed making around $60,000 a year to a poor college student now. I've noticed I'm much more hesitant to go out, right? To go do something. I had a couple of guys that wanted me to come out for drinks last night and I didn't. I mean, A, because I don't really drink, but secondly, I didn't have $20, $30 to spend on alcohol. So the thing is, I've noticed that's actually kind of dictated a lot of my social decisions. Not that I didn't want to go see those guys, even if I didn't drink, but just the fact of having to go out and have that pressure, having to pay for gas to get there, all those things factor into the size of our friend circle or maybe opportunities that we can't take that we would have that would have extended. We would have met more people at, you know, said event, but couldn't go because we couldn't afford the ticket or the gas to get there or the whatever it is. So you have those two factors that kind of affect your friendship, your circle, and the extent of your reach. And those are the regional differences and then the economic conditions. So small circle, poor, I have Britain, and big circle equal, you know, when times are good, when you have more money, you're more willing to accept those offers, to go out more, to pay for more, et cetera. So it makes sense. The last source I have here that I thought was interesting was the title's funny, public service announcement. You don't have to be friends with everyone. And that kind of went into kind of what I ultimately decided for myself is that for the, you know, going back to my story at the beginning, that I kind of can give myself permission to not have to be best friends with every single person. Like if they want to go do stuff on their own, that's fine. Like I don't have to be involved in every single one of those interactions. I don't have to be best friends with everyone because that's A, exhausting, and B, impossible to do. What is her name? Christy Oshoni, I think. Psychotherapist. She specializes in a lot of different areas, but the one that applies to this is relationships and dating. But she talks about, and her quote here, she talks about reading an old story by Truman Capote, actually in the 40s. But she says, I was thinking about this recently while reading Shut a Final Door, a short story written in the 40s by Truman Capote. At the beginning of the story, a character named Anna addresses her exceptionally self-involved, uncaring friend, Walter. Her aim is to end their relationship, which is a friendship, not to be, they weren't like together. But she says plainly to him, sorry, Walter, I can't afford you any longer. And what struck me about this statement was the idea of not being able to afford a friendship. And she goes on to say, certainly Anna does not mean that she has to actually shell out cash in order to keep her friendship afloat. Instead, she's talking about a different sort of cost, an emotional price that must be paid in order to be in a relationship with someone. So what was interesting in reading that for me was that while you do have this economic side to friendship and how that affects your circles, you also have this flip side of the coin, which is the emotional cost or the social cost that you essentially pay to be friends with someone. And if they're not really willing to give that back or to invest really anything in you, then it's kind of a one-way street, and that's really not a healthy friendship. So what I learned at the end of the day is that not everyone's going to be a friend, but that is also okay. So you want to focus on the people that want you in their lives, that make an effort, and then don't worry about the rest. And I found in my own experience that life kind of has a way of making those people come into your life and stay in your life, those people that are good for you. So you shouldn't have to, you know, chase people or chase friends. I think this is from the same source. I'm going to say this is from the same melissagriffinblog.com. It says, when we choose our friends, something more than magic leads us to them. We need to be in the position to want to make friends. Oh, this is why I put this in here, because it was funny. Because she says, and have the spoons to be able to maintain that new friendship. Which I don't really know what that means. Like, does she mean like the money, I guess, to like, I don't know. I have no idea what that means. Have the spoons to be able to maintain that new friendship. Anyway, at the end of the day, those were kind of some of the thoughts I had on that, but that all kind of stemmed from that interaction that I had last week, and kind of just, you know, thinking, well, this kind of, you know, this is not ideal. But at the end of the day, kind of came to the conclusion that actually that's perfectly normal and okay, because that's what weeds people out. And trying to be friends with everyone is exhausting and not really rewarding, I found at the end of the day.
I really like that. I think there's a ton of different directions to go with that. That's because it's a super fascinating topic. Real quick, I looked up the spoon thing. So the spoon theory, real quick, can you read the context that she used it in? Because this is a little bit of a complicated definition, so I think it'll help.
Let me go back. When we choose our friends, something more than magic leads us to them. We need to be in the position to want to make friends and have the spoons to be able to maintain that new friendship.
Okay, so the spoon theory is, according to this, a disability metaphor for a combination of ego depletion, fatigue, and other factors, and neologism, probably saying that wrong, used to explain the reduced amount of mental and physical energy available for activities of living and productive tasks that may result from disability or chronic illness. So I think like a person only has a limited number of spoons that are consumed by activities throughout the day. So it's kind of like, I've heard this as like the light bulb analogy. Like if you're on a bike and your bike is powering three light bulbs and one is family, one is work, and one is passion, the battle is to equally distribute the power between those three bulbs. And if you, you know, give more juice to the passion bulb, then either the work or the family bulb is going to have to dim, and et cetera, et cetera. I think it's a similar concept.
I like that. Kind of that metaphor for just us having a finite amount of resources, and we can't, I mean, there's no way to physically distribute that equally over this, you know, exponential amount of people. So you kind of have to pick and choose.
Yeah. And in the spirit of, you know, what we're doing here, which is kind of, I think, A, working through these things, but also B, kind of creating this interesting archive of, you know, us figuring this stuff out for the first time, going through a process that a ton of our peers are going through right now, just in a more public fashion. I've definitely have been feeling that recently with where I'm at. It's interesting. We talked about this before, where you were working at the Capitol and extremely busy, and I was freelance writing and just trying to make all that work, which meant that I had a ton of free time and you had almost none. And then I went on full time and lost all my free time. And that's about the time that you left the Capitol, and all of a sudden you had all the free time. And as I've been like that in and of itself, my full time job is, you know, it's just 40 hours a week, 8 to 5. So it hasn't been that detrimental to my social life, especially since all my friends are adults who either work or in college. So, you know, we hang out on the weekends and that's about it. But I recently signed on as a part time employee at a video production company. And so I'm going to be working for them after my full-time job, and I'm doing stuff like this and my own creative work. So it's basically two part-time jobs and a full-time job at that point. Like, and that's the thing that I've had to think about, you know, is like I have the privilege of being in a friend group that's very tight-knit, and, you know, we hang out all the time, usually multiple times in a week, maybe two or three, especially on the weekends. So if there comes a point where I have to make the choice, you know, which is more important? What do I need to do? Where do they fall on my list of priorities? You know, how much power am I willing to give to that bulb as opposed to the passions that I'm trying to build up? Like, I want my creative stuff to pay my bills within the next 2 years. And, you know, that's no small feat. I need to be putting time to that. I need to prioritize that. But I also don't want to just blow my friends off. You know? So I think that we'll be able to explore that a little bit more and explore where you're at a little bit more as we delve into this topic. But I really appreciated the research that you put into that. There's a lot of really good material there. I think the big question that I had right off the bat was before now, like obviously you're in a bit of a transitional time in your mentality towards friendships, social activities, that kind of thing. But before this point, it sounds like you would say that you were more of the more the merrier kind of guy, like more friendships is better and kind of wanting as many people to like you as possible. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say that's definitely true.
So would you say that you fell pretty much into the definition of that mindset that you gave, or would you add or detract anything from the definition that you gave earlier about like basically as many friendships as possible, but shallower level with the ability to dive in deeper if necessary?
I would say that probably dominated a lot of my thinking. And I think that also stemmed from, because I was kind of doing the research and seeing why that might be. I think that also kind of stemmed from the fact that, you know, economical resources were good. I had the ability to do that. A lot of my really close friends were at work. So it wasn't like I had to really go super far out of my way. There was a real great, you know, camaraderie there among those people. And you spend freaking 70, 80 hours a week with them. So I mean, you either hate them or you love them. So yeah, I would absolutely say though, yes, that would probably be what I fit into. I think that's kind of among lots of other things that are shifting. It would include that mindset and that approach to life, is that kind of before it was, you know, trying to know more people. And that's also, I think that also came from a political mindset, in terms of that was kind of my job as a staffer to make more connections and extend that circle as many opportunities as I had. And whether you wanted to or not, that kind of carries over into your personal life. It's hard to turn that off. So that would kind of be what I would kind of carry over personally. So I think a lot of things are changing for the good, honestly, in the transition that I made, including that mindset on friends and acquaintances and how all those interact.
So that actually goes to what my next question was going to be, saying that like this is a change for the better, because I'm aware of this dichotomy. Obviously, I've always been aware that this was like, there are people that have a lot more friends or that have that mentality, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I have always naturally been the opposite, which I'm sure you know, we've known each other long enough now. Like from as long as I can remember, I usually, in whatever place I'm plugged into, in the various places I've lived, I'll plug in with a relatively small group, like 2 to 3 people, usually, sometimes a little bit bigger. The friend group that I'm in now already existed before I got here, and then I was kind of brought into it. So that one's a little bit bigger. But in the groups that I've been in that kind of just formed, it was usually maybe 3 or 4 of us at most. And that's about it. And we would hang out and we had a good time and did that for years until, you know, we pretty much, the only time that I've ever stopped hanging out with a group of people is because like one or more of us moved away. That's the only reason. There's never been anything quite like what you're talking about, because that's not how my friendships have ever operated. But in that same vein, I've never thought of it as better or worse, just different. Like, oh, some people are like A, some people are like James, and some people are like me, and whatever. And so I find it intriguing that A, that you're coming to a different point in it, which is interesting in and of itself, but then furthermore, that you would say that this is an upgrade or an improvement. So I'm wondering if you can expound on that idea, that this is, that one is favorable to the other.
Right. And that I'm still kind of determining. But I've found, I guess just in my past, that it's always more rewarding to have those few people that know you really well, especially when it comes to hard times, when it comes to difficult times. And I think that's also what the article had gone into, is talking about how you value those close friendships when you're not as well off, and you value the amount of friends more when you're fine. But I would say that it's kind of shifting in the sense that what's interesting too for me is that I wouldn't really consider myself an extrovert. I would say that I would maybe be somewhere between the two, but I think when I took a test, it was like 51-49. It was close, but like the bent was toward introversion. So if I'm left to my own devices, like I'm not going to like be the guy in the middle of the room, you know, shaking everybody's hand, but I'm also not going to be in the corner not talking to anyone. So I'll be somewhere in between the two. But so for me, with kind of more of an introverted bent, this is uncommon, I found in my research, but I consider people friends very quickly, in terms of they break through the acquaintance to the friend circle in my own mind, faster than they probably would for an introvert normally. Because when I was looking at the research, they were saying that introverts are very selective about people that they would consider friends normally. And I, for me, if we've talked, like we've had like, you know, it depends on each interaction. But for me, just it seemed like I would make that determination quicker than someone with my brain or someone as an introvert normally would do. So I think that may have been part of it, is that I considered a lot of people friends that maybe weren't necessarily friends, if that makes sense. Like they were still in the acquaintance circle on their end, probably didn't even necessarily consider me a friend per se, but people that on my side I would consider friends or even close friends, depending on the level of interaction. Apparently that's kind of an anomaly for an introvert. That's kind of the shift I've also been making, is kind of saying like, you know, this, I don't have to consider this person a friend. There's no, you know, there's no burden or pressure to do that. But that definition is different for everyone. So that's kind of one of those things. But anyway, I guess it's kind of a long answer to saying that I would definitely say it's preferable, especially where I'm at right now anyway, to have that smaller close-knit group than have a whole bunch of people that don't really know me. The antithesis, though, of like of a story like It's a Wonderful Life, right, where he knows a bunch of people, he's touched their lives, but they all come together for him in the end, right? So yeah, it just depends. It's all opinion, and it all just wherever you're at in your life, it may be different. But that's just what I found in the past couple months.
No, and I mean, I think that's fascinating, and it, because I had considered that, and especially just in the context of like analyzing whether or not my own tendencies were good. Just like, should I try to be more extroverted? Should I try to have that larger friend base? And for me, the conclusion was pretty, I had come to the point where I was like, I don't think that what I'm doing is bad. So, and it's more or less natural for me to do. I like where I'm at, so I'm going to stick with it. But it was never necessarily an indictment of the other side of that coin. So, I think that aside from, I would say the same thing that I say for most things, honestly, which is that there needs to be a balance between the two. Where, like, if you're totally blocking yourself off, you're not doing yourself any favors, and you're not living up to your fullest potential. But on the other hand, if you're out to make as many friends as possible, especially when it comes to, you know, your own emotional stability, where, you know, you need the validation of other people, then you're running into an issue. I think there are dangers on both sides. That I swing the same way as you. I know for a fact I'm exactly 49% extroverted and 51% introverted. So yeah,
it's exactly the same.
Yeah, the exact same. And so yeah, like I slight swing towards introversion, but very much an ambivert. I can be on my own just fine, but if I need to be social, that's not an issue. And so, you know, finding that balance, finding the strengths in both, admittedly, is probably easier for someone like us who naturally has those tendencies on both sides. I think the interesting thing would be to talk to someone who swings really hard in one direction, because there's a lot to overcome there. And I don't think that one or the other is the answer. I think that there's merit to both sides, so it's about finding that balance. But yeah, like if in a case like yours, when you're being thrown out might be an overdramatic term, but
shut out maybe
from, yeah, you're being excluded from a friend group that you've been in for especially something that long, that's rough. And so you have to consider, and it makes sense that this is an issue that you're dealing with, because you have to then consider like, what value do I place on these friends? Like, why is this having that much of an impact on me? And I have dealt with that through people close to me who have dealt with similar things. So by extension, you know, I'm walking alongside them and seeing how that's worked out. And that's always what it's come back to, is what value do I place on these friendships? It's so easy to be defined by our emotional reaction to things, to say, I feel like crap, and then just kind of swim in that and just continue like, I feel like crap. And so I feel like crap, therefore crappy feelings. And that's it. As opposed to, I don't feel so good right now. This is the thing that caused it. Why do I feel that way? And I think that's an area where you're very much on the right track of just saying like analyzing why am I upset about this? Why, like, there's an, you could easily say I've been wronged, so I'm upset and that's the end of it. But instead, kind of digging into it more and seeing how you can be better, I think is the most productive answer. Because at the end of the day, I mean, even if they're completely in the wrong, there's nothing you can do about that. That's not productive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
This way you're finding, I mean, you're allowing yourself to grow and evolve in a way that's really cool out of what could have just been a sucky situation.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I did struggle with that at first, kind of just like, you know, just thinking about it way too much and like, why don't, you know, like just overthinking things. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's kind of like what you were saying, like, why is this bothering me so much? And on the flip side of that, should I really even be considering them friends if they don't place that same value on me that I do in them? Then it's just better just to cut your losses at that point. It's like, you're just not at the point that you thought you were with them.
There's this sense of almost Stockholm syndrome. That's like, even if they, like, if someone's shutting you out and they're treating you like garbage, good, you dodged a bullet, man. Like, okay, moving on. It's hard because of the emotions attached to it. Emotions don't really respond super well to reason most of the time. I think that's a discipline side of it is, when you feel that emotion, like I was saying, falling back on reason, why am I feeling this? How can I control this? How can I optimize what's going on right now? And it sounds kind of cold and calculated, but the incredible increase in quality of life by following up a strong emotional reaction with just mental analysis is incredible. If you just swim in the emotion, that's how you go downhill really fast.
That's true. I mean, the alternative is that, is just that, where you're up till 3 a.m. overthinking things. And I mean, it doesn't get you anywhere. So it's best just to, you know, cut those people out if you can. And it's nothing personal. It's just, you have to do what's best for you and your own mental health. And those are just kind of the decisions that you have to make sometimes. So yeah, I've just felt it's better just to, and that's kind of another thing I've been doing is really working on truly cutting out toxic people and toxic influences from my life, whether that be like a media source or a person, because it's just life is way too short to have to deal with that. And, you know, it's nothing personal against them, but it's just, once again, it comes back to, you have to do what is best for you. You can't make everyone happy. That's just a very disappointing, frustrating way to live, is trying to make everyone happy and trying to be everybody's friend. So you just can't, you can't do it.
So in that vein of media, let's talk a little bit about social media. You addressed it briefly, and I find it very apropos in terms of like what we've been talking about with the emotional side of it, because I think it would be very apt to describe social media as an emotional narcotic, where it's very much built on giving you that dopamine hit of, oh, it's a like, it's a whatever, and then consuming other people's lives as content, basically, which is kind of a crazy thing. And again, this is a thing where we in the past have been on very different sides of the coin. I've never been particularly into social media, partially just from the fact that my parents would not allow me on social media as a kid. So I think I got on social media around the age of 16 or 17. You know, I think it was like 17 or even 18 before I got on social media. And by the time I got there, I didn't care. Like, it's fine, it's whatever. Honestly, if it was not for the fact that I want to make a living doing this kind of thing, the only social media I would probably keep would be Reddit, because I really actually enjoy Reddit. Probably Facebook, because, you know, like, most of my family is across the country, and so it's a good way to keep in touch. But even that, I would not check on a regular basis at all if it were not for trying to make a living by reaching people through the internet. Whereas you, while we entered social media around the same time, I think you were there a little bit before me, you were much more involved. And I know I saw a lot of that from the outside. So I'm wondering if you can expound on that a little bit and to where you are now, because I find that transition fascinating. I think it'd be cool for our listeners to hear too.
Yeah, so I was much the same with you in terms of my parents didn't really let me get on. And I think even then it was just Facebook when I first got on. And then I got Instagram and Snapchat and Twitter and everything else. So at one point I had all four, and it was a lot, honestly, to keep up with. But I think when I finally made the decision to get off, and so right now I just have Snapchat. It's the only thing I have. I'm not on anything else right now. Was when I would just catch myself throughout the day, and I would just be like, just opening the apps and, you know, refreshing for like no reason, you know, and I would do that every 5 minutes or whatever it was. And there was just really, I just came to the conclusion that there was just no need for me to be on that except for the validation that social media had, right? In terms of that, those likes and those, that, that validation from your peers, I guess. It was hard. It was really, really hard for the first week. And I think I actually staggered getting off. I think I got off Twitter and Facebook and then Instagram last. It was real tough for that first week. And you'd even like open your phone and go and like, oh, that's right, I don't have that app. Like it was that much ingrained in just my habit. And so what I found, and if you really want a wake up call, if you, I don't know if you can do this on your phone since you have a dumb Samsung phone or whatever you have, but if you go to the settings, you can look at your screen time.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I can do that.
Okay. Fancy. And you can see like how much of the percentage of time you're using, how many minutes it adds up to per week. And that was to me like the biggest wake up call, because it is always more time than you would guess. Getting off that was one of the best decisions I think I've made. And every now and again, I'll feel the pull to kind of get back on there. But what I've kind of trained myself to do is just think through why I want to get back on. And there's really not a good reason for it when I explore it, because at this point in time, and kind of like what you said, you're using it for business or for economic reasons. But for me, there would be no reason other than personal reasons to get back on. The people that I would care enough to keep in touch with, either I know on Snapchat or they have my number. So it's really, if I'm being honest with myself, it's not that important for me to have either Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. But honestly, no, it's been great for, I don't want to be that guy. It's like, you know, you shouldn't have social media. Like, cause obviously, you know, you make whatever decision is going to work for you. I'm just telling you for my own personal experience, it was better for me not to have those things. Cause especially working in politics, Twitter was a huge negative reinforcement, because there's a constant barrage of negative media and politics and everything going wrong. So really not much of an upside to it as far as I could see. So I think getting off was a good choice. I may get on eventually again if I have a reason to do that, but I've really been working on not getting back on that unless I can really give myself a good reason why I should be on there and why it would be a positive instead of a drain on my time and that negative influence, whether that be lack of dopamine or lack of likes and then me trying to overcorrect by spending more time on there, or whether that just be seeing a bunch of posts about how America is going down the toilet, whatever it is. Anyway, it was a good decision for me personally to get off. And I noticed a huge change in my own mental health in terms of, well, A, more time, but just also not having to worry about that constant, you know, refreshing, going through, responding to things, liking stuff, having to keep up with other people's posts and making sure I don't miss likes and then people saying like, you know, why didn't you like my last post? Blah, blah, blah. So yeah, it was just great to get out of that for me at the time. Like I said, may get on again one day, but that was my own experience. I know for you, you're on it, but you don't really spend a whole lot of time on it. So I don't know if your experience is probably very different than mine in terms of how that worked.
So I have only recently, I actually since having a full-time job, started to be on Facebook a little bit more. Just basically like awkward amounts of time of not having anything, or basically just feeling like I was too tired to do anything else. This is like, I'll see what's on Facebook, and plugging into a couple different communities on Facebook that I hadn't been on before that are actually more interesting, just like film groups and that kind of stuff. But within a month of that, I had this moment. I think it was fortunate, and it was very much owed to the fact that I had not started at a young age. But within a month of that, there was one time where I had been on Facebook for like, it was maybe like 30 minutes on a lunch break. And I shut it down. I was like, okay, I have to go back to work now. I had a book next to me that I had intended to read and didn't. And the thought that I had was, what did I gain from that experience? And there was nothing. It was just a time vortex that, you know, I went into it at, you know, like 12:30 and came out of it at 1:00. And there was like nothing had happened. And that was really depressing to me. And so from then on, I've been making an active effort to just not, I still have the apps on my phone, which was easy enough for me to do just because I didn't have a real habit built up. But honestly, like I really I really respect that move. And I have an interesting thing in lieu of that. But I want to ask one question first that just occurred to me. When did you make the jump off social media altogether? Was that sometime like last year?
Gee, that was about, yeah, it was about a year ago, I think now or so.
Okay. So, would, just to make it easy, would 2017 social media user James King, if the situation that happened to you recently with the friend group and whatnot, if that happened to you, but your social media usage was circa 2017 James, do you think that you would be able to make the decision and the progress that you're making now, or would it be completely different?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question because a lot's different now in terms of my job and social media and the friends that I have now. Man, I don't know. I think that, you know, being on all those things kind of puts you on heightened alert for all these little things. And like, to me, I would definitely notice if someone didn't like something or liked, you know, around my post basically, you know, or liked a comment but didn't like the post. I was like, well, what the heck's their problem? You know, so like, it kind of puts you on like this on edge basically. And it's, at least for me, it was kind of like, you know, is there something wrong? Did I do something? You know, and so used to kind of overthinking the situation. So probably for me, I would say probably that this would have been a bigger deal than it was to me. The whole getting kind of closed out of my own group, that would have been probably a much, much bigger deal if I would have had social media, which is interesting because you would think it would be the opposite because I have, you know, 600, whatever it was, followers on Instagram. So you would think, oh, it's fine. You know, you have like this broad network, so it shouldn't be an issue to lose a couple. But in actuality, that probably would have made it worse.
And that actually goes right into the other thing that I had alluded to, which is as of late, I've seen a trend starting. As far as I know, it was started by Casey Neistat, but I have done no research into where it would have come from. Casey Neistat's the first place I saw it. But he recently, I think he's done two videos that I've seen on it to date, talking about his own social media addiction and what he's done to break it. And I find that intriguing, especially given that he has the exact same excuse that I would say I have, which is that he makes some money, or he makes some money, he makes a living, you know, working online. And he said he has very similar experience. Like when you're talking about app tracking and all that, he mentions the exact same thing in his video where he's like, I'm spending, you know, 3 hours a day on Twitter. And that's absurd. You know, there's so many other things that could be done with that time. And his solution was he removed the apps from his phone. He's still on social media, but he basically will check it for maybe like 15, 30 minutes on a laptop at the end of the day. So he made that initial video announcing it, and he made another video kind of addressing his experience with it thus far. After he did it, Philip DeFranco did the same thing. And those are the only two people that I follow that have done it. I wouldn't be surprised. Those guys are both pretty big on YouTube right now, so I wouldn't be surprised to see other people following their lead. I'll insert a Casey Neistat quote here if I find it.
For me, the cost of using Twitter nearly an hour a day was all of my damn attention. And the value, the return, was a little bit of information for sure, but a lot of noise.
Which goes to what I was talking about earlier, just like 30 minutes disappearing. It's static, like it's kind of hypnotizing almost. Like it sucks you in, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, there a day is gone, you know? And so I find it interesting that this is something that's kind of penetrating the mainstream as well. And I'll be very curious to see how that goes because, like, as far as the psychological effects of social media goes, we have no idea. Like all of this is so new. Like when the answers to these questions are known, the people that will be writing the books on it will be using us as the case study.
Right. It is really fascinating, honestly. And it's weird because, like, 20 years ago, you could have pitched this as a Black Mirror episode. That's what's crazy.
I forget. Are you caught up on Black Mirror?
I have seen one episode of Black Mirror, and it was the Christmas one with Jon Hamm.
That's a great episode. We should do a follow-up, doing a deep dive into one particular Black Mirror episode.
Ooh, I like it.
I'm looking it up right now because they have one about social media. There it is. The one that jumps into it headfirst is season 3, episode 1. It's called Nosedive. The synopsis is a woman desperate to boost her social media score hits the jackpot when she's invited to a swanky wedding, but the trip doesn't go as planned.
Oh, I've heard of this one. I've heard about this one. She's
Fantastic
like,
episode.
and this is that the one where they send the bees or whatever to kill people?
Different episode.
Oh, different one. Okay. Well, I think I've heard of that one, but yeah, I would absolutely be down to watch that slash. dive into it. Nose dive into it.
I'm going to write that down because I think that'd be a fun follow-up to this episode.
You didn't hear my joke, did you?
Did you say just jump into it?
I said slash nose dive.
Ha! I'm glad I missed it the first time.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Not my best. But.
So in the vein of like us being the test case for it, I recently have been thinking about this a lot in regards to my own siblings. Both of my siblings have had a lot more access to social media than I did at their age. They've grown up with it. It's much more, and even that's partially the age at which they got on social media, partially that they latched onto it a whole heck of a lot more than I did. And so it's been fascinating to see the differences that are, like, there's a ton of differences between us. And, you know, it's not only hard, but arguably impossible to determine exactly where all those differences come from. But I do think that there's a significant role that social media plays in the differences between us. And it's like I said, like, this is this generation of kids coming up right now, like the kids that are getting on Facebook at 10, they're the ones that are going to tell us the effects that social media has on the brain. Until that is known, like, it's a gamble. And honestly, like, as someone who's about to be a dad, it's not a gamble that I'm really willing to take. Call me an overprotective parent or whatever.
A fuddy-duddy.
Yeah, but I probably would adopt a policy of, you know, no social media until you're an adult, you know? Like, because there's no point. That you don't need it. Like, develop as a person. And then if you want to get it, like, I don't, that's what I'm trying to say. I don't want social media to be a part of your development. If you want to jump into social media as a fully formed human being, fine, do what you want. But social media should not be an integral part of what shapes the human being you become. I think that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the thing is, like, that was, and that's so weird to even think about bringing up kids without a smartphone, because I see all these kids with phones that are 5 and 6 years old. It's just crazy. But I mean, because for me growing up, and I'm sure it was the same for you, like, my parents were, and there were kids that had, I mean, you had what, MySpace and that kind of thing, but it was nowhere near on the same scale as it is now. But it was very much, you know, get outside, go play. And we had tons of, and just on our street alone, that we would go around, ride bikes, do cops and robbers, all that kind of thing, hang out in each other's yards well into, you know, being 15, 16 years old. So it was that was, you know, your social media, right? At the time, that's how you got your social interaction. And it was, I still remember, like, calling my neighbor's house, like, to ask if their kid, like, their son was home. Like, you'd call the parents on the landline, right? It's like, I still remember that. And I'm really not that old. So a lot has changed, and it's going to be very interesting, like you were saying, to see this, especially not even Generation Z, which are, you know, probably our siblings are considered, but even though they're kids, like your kids, like, and it's crazy to even think about bringing someone up without a phone. Like, that thought is just crazy to me. I don't know how that would work practically, but I mean, for me, it would be, if I ever have kids, it would be the same. But I say that, but I also don't know practically how that would be, how you would do that, you know? So there's a lot to figure out, for sure.
There really is. And, like, it's a challenge, but I really, and this, I mean, I was going to say this is a rabbit trail, but that's actually kind of the point of the show. So I'm not even going to worry about it. It also, I don't think that easier should be the primary factor that informs the parental decisions that we make. And that actually goes beyond parental decisions to just the decisions we make about our own lives, you know? And that applies to specifically what we're talking about here, which is, like, yeah, would it be easier for your kid to just have a smartphone and be able to be plugged in logistically? Heck yeah, it would be easier. That should not be what informs whether or not your child has a smartphone. I see that a lot too with, like, honestly, kids' TV makes me sad. Like, it's such garbage. And it makes me sad because I feel like it doesn't have to be. I heard this quote somewhere and I can't remember who said it, so I apologize for not crediting where credit is due. They said, I think it might have been Jeremy Johns. But now I'm maybe miscrediting, so whatever. It's definitely not anything that I'm going to be able to recover. But he basically said, like, there was a time when children's... Actually, you know what? I'm pretty sure it was Jeremy John, so I'm just going to double down on that and be wrong if I'm wrong. But he said that there was a time when children's entertainment, like the people making it, knew that the parents were going to be stuck watching this crap too. And so there was some responsibility on their end to make it like good. And now, because, you know, smartphones are a thing and it's not at all uncommon for families to have more than one TV in the house, there's no responsibility anymore. Like, oh, look, it's flashing tie-dye lights and that's the show and that's it. And it's mind-numbing. And I don't think, I think especially when it comes to a kid, but even for an adult, we should not meet them or ourselves where we are. Yeah, kids can be dumb and will be entertained by tie-dye and fart jokes. That doesn't mean we should give them that.
Right. Just keep pressing the easy button.
Yeah. Give them something that's a little... I'm not saying they need to be watching Citizen Kane, but give them something with a little bit more depth that they can be entertained by and let them rise to that. I think that I would say from my own experiences that Mr. Rogers and VeggieTales were perfect for that.
Oh, yeah. Those are two. Yeah, Mr. Rogers is my favorite show all time growing up.
As an adult, I will watch either of those shows and be fine. Like, there's levels to it. It's super fascinating. It's great. And, like, a show like VeggieTales 2, still funny, weirdly.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah,
those
absolutely.
Jokes still land. I think that we should be meeting people. We should be meeting children there, which goes to that second part of, like, you know, yes, it would be easier to go to Taco Bell instead of making yourself something that's not killing you. And for the record, like, I'm getting on a soapbox here a little bit, but I am, like, preaching to myself because I'm 100% the guy that'll be like, oh, yeah, like, I'll just get something. Honestly, if it weren't for the fact that I have a wife, I would probably be a fat slob. It's just way easier. But, you know, my wife cares about me enough that she'll prepare stuff and help me out. And so I have that luxury, but I'm under no illusion that if I was on my own, I would have that at all, you know? It's crazy to me that we would meet people, whether children, adults, ourselves, where they are, because it's easier, and be okay with that. I feel like that falls apart under the least bit of scrutiny.
Yeah, but that's the mindset that's more or less dominated the media that is produced for children or young adults now. Even the old Disney Channel, that still holds up. You know, if you watch those old shows like, Wizards of Waverly Place or Victorious, or like even ones that aren't that old, but like you turn it on now, it's such absolute garbage. And I don't know why that is, because it seems like it's obviously not just Disney, but that's just across the board. That's been kind of there's just been a decline in the amount of effort that's put in. And maybe it is because they figured out that formula and they don't need really to try that hard, and so they don't. Or I don't know what it is, but it seems kind of like you're saying, it seems like that's a pretty widespread ideology that's been used in the production of these shows. But I don't know.
So there's one other subject that I want to jump into here before we wrap up. It's something that you said near the end of your spiel, talking specifically about the effort that you put into a friend group or a specific friend versus the reward that you get out of it. I find that dichotomy interesting. I think dichotomy is the word of the day. I'm pretty sure I've said that at least twice now.
It's a good word.
It is. It's fun. We'll keep using it. But I find that interplay, mix it up, interesting, because on the one hand, I totally get it. And there's a purely logistical level or purely practical level in which it makes sense to say, you know, this friend is toxic, or what am I gaining from associating with this group of people? And if the answer is nothing, well, then I'm out. Peace. You know, I'm going to cut those ties, going to unfollow, block, whatever I need to do. On the other side of that coin, there's a level of pouring into other people. There's a level of, you know, the Good Samaritan, where, you know, we're not necessarily in friendships or in relationships for the benefit that we get out of them. Like, I don't subscribe to the Randian philosophy of everything is for our own selfish ambition. There's this one interview with her. I actually do know. I'm going to put the quote in here.
You are married?
Yes.
Your husband, is he an industrialist?
No, he's an artist. His name is Frank O'Connor.
Does he live from his painting?
He's just beginning to study painting. He was a designer before.
Is he supported in his efforts by the state?
Most certainly not.
He's supported by you for the time being?
No, by his own work, actually, in the past.
Well, I know.
By me, if necessary, but that isn't quite necessary.
And there is no contradiction here in that you help him?
No, because you see, I am in love with him selfishly. It is to my own interest to help him if he ever needed it. I would not call that a sacrifice because I take selfish pleasure in it.
I don't buy that. As a Christian, I think that there is I think that selflessness does exist. And so I guess the
pure acts of kindness. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think to put that into a question form, I'm asking, where does the line between friendship and a relationship that you form for the purpose of maybe helping or being kind to someone that you think needs it, where does that line exist? And how does that change the lesson that you've learned from your recent experiences?
Dang, well, that's a that's a very complicated question. I think it kind of all goes back to the social exchange theory, right? I don't know if you've heard of that. It's in kind of a psychological term that they use for basically when you are meeting someone, you do this not really consciously, or maybe some people do, but you kind of determine in your mind if the cost outweighs the benefit of being this person's friend. So in other words, we take the benefit, subtract the costs, and then that's the determination of how much that relationship is worth to you. And so it's different for everyone. Everyone has different ways of calculating that. You know, maybe someone's cost may be not important to someone else. They may not factor that in. So it's different for everyone, obviously. But I think that's where the line is drawn from a purely psychological standpoint in most people's minds. But I, like you, like to believe that there are still pure acts of kindness, and there are people that are not motivated by selfish, self-centered desires, because I like to think that there are people that still exist like that, and that, you know, if someone truly needed my help and there was nothing that they could do for me, that I would still help them. I would think that I would do that. But I also understand the flip side of that coin in terms of you might help other people because it makes you feel good about yourself. And so that there's never really truly, I guess, a selfless act. But so I understand what the point is being made there. I just don't agree with it really. But that's tough. I mean, that's kind of like you said, though, I think that really is only found in the Christian faith in terms of sacrifice, especially in the example of Jesus, when there was literally nothing that we could give to him and him paying the ultimate price. That's obviously where you see the most pure, perfect example of that. But I like to think that since we're created in his image, we're still capable of doing something, you know, to that effect. Not obviously with that magnitude or with that same effect that he had, but we're still capable of those types of acts. You know what I mean? Laying down your life for your friend, I think, is the example that he gives in the Bible, the greatest love for us. How has that changed the lesson that I have learned? I don't know that it has. I'm trying to think through how that might influence that. Because really what I kind of took away from that is that I kind of am giving myself permission not to have to chase people or not to have to be everyone's friend. And so I'll still hang out with them on occasion. And there's a specific reason why I'm going to see them every week, which I won't mention because that will divulge who they are. But so I'll still do that and everything. And I'll still be cordial and nice, obviously. But the reality is that not everyone can be friends. And then kind of goes back to that social exchange thing. Like, some people are going to be better friends just for the reason that they're at different places in their life and have different values or different beliefs, or, you know, age gaps, whatever it may be. So that kind of determines, those things are sometimes out of your control. So that's why I think it's much more rewarding to make those closer friends and not have to worry about chasing those big circles or extending your network in your own personal life. If you can do that for business, that's a whole different thing, I guess. But there was somewhere else I was going to go with that, and now I can't remember what I was going to say.
This is why you got to take notes.
I know, man. I've been doing this all off the top of my head. But that's what it was. I do remember what I was going to say. I don't know what sound that was, inaudible. The fact is that, obviously you're going to be at different points in your life with some friends. So what I was saying earlier wasn't that if someone isn't giving you value to, you know, cut them off. What I'm talking about are actual toxic influences from people that are not, they don't care about your best interests. They themselves are self-centered and they're only using you to get X, like whatever that may be, X item. Those kinds of people, the people you want to cut those influences out. But obviously, sometimes you'll be off, sometimes you'll be on with certain friends where they may need you to help them, and then maybe other times when you may need them. But that's part of friendship. That's just life. But to me, what I'm saying toxic, I'm talking about those few examples of people that you've allowed in your lives that are a detriment to you as a person and that are a literal drain constantly to you as a person. Those are the people, those are the influences you want to cut out, because they're not improving your life in any way. And to me, friendship is a mutually beneficial overall interaction. So, and of course, once again, that there may be different times where you give to someone else, they give back to you, whatever it is. But I think you can, when you see a toxic relationship, you'll know it type thing. And it's different for everyone once again, but there are certain people out there that are definitely not looking out for your best interests, and you don't want those people in your life. So that's what I was talking about when I said that. Not that obviously your friend's not going to be 100% giving to you constantly. That's just not the way friendship works. And that's not the way marriage works. It's not reality. I'm talking about like a constant drain type situation.
I like, as much as that feels like a given, I do think it's a really important distinction to know what you're cutting out, because it can very easily become an excuse of, you know, this person is making me uncomfortable, or this situation is hard. If a friend is calling you out for something, it can be easy to say, well, you know what, I don't need you in my life, so peace out. Whereas a lot of times, you know, that's the whole point of having a friend, is someone who's willing to call you out when you need to be.
Right. And I would argue that a true friend would call you out and would not say nothing if they saw a harmful pattern or something emerging in your life. Someone who doesn't say anything would be the one you don't want as your friend, right?
And that in and of itself would appear to be, by and large, countercultural in the sense that what is at least the loudest, if not the most prominent, this idea that, you know, being a friend is just being there and supporting no matter what. There's this great in air quotes book. You've watched Last Week Tonight, right?
I don't think I have, actually.
Oh, well, there you go. Last Week Tonight. So John Oliver, it's on HBO. It's a pretty good show. I enjoy it. It's a more, you know, it's in the late night vein.
Stephen Colbert-ish.
Yeah. Do deep dives on political issues. It's more geared toward that specifically than like entertainment, gossip and whatnot. But it's still like its purpose is to be comedic, more or less. And they did this one. I can't even remember what the stupid bunny's name was.
Marlon Bundo.
But when Vice President Pence, he or a ghostwriter or whatever, released a book about a life in the day of their bunny. And so when that happened, Last Week Tonight did a video. They released a book in correlation with their show that was basically a retelling of the story if the bunny was gay. And that is whatever. I'm not really interested in delving into that issue here. The refrain of that book, regardless of what you think of the issue that they're tackling, I find to be kind of terrifying, which is basically like the bunny has all of his, he has all of his various animal friends, and you know, he meets another bunny and they fall in love, and the refrain of the book is, and they all said hooray because that's what friends say. It's something akin to that. I might be misquoting a little bit, but like, no, that's not what friends, like, yeah, friends should be there to celebrate with you, but the idea that friends should just celebrate whatever you do, I mean, maybe I'm missing something.
I would say that's a toxic trait.
That's it's an enabling relationship.
Right. Like, yes, yes,
you're
right.
You're becoming codependent at that point, and I find that crazy, regardless of what the issue is. Yeah, friends do say hooray, but that's not their whole purpose. It's not the point of having a friend. But that seems very much informed by this kind of social media, like, oh, all my friends like my tweet type of mentality. And I don't think that's healthy.
Well, essentially what you have is just a row of bobbleheads at that point. It's just like, you know, I mean, yeah, and where is the, I don't understand the level of friendship, I guess, there. I don't, because to me that's not what someone who truly loves you, truly supports you would do if they see you doing something stupid. But obviously when you do something good or when you're celebrating something, sure. But yeah, no, I agree.
Very good. Is there anything you would like to throw in to wrap us up?
No, I don't think so. I think I got through everything. And I appreciate the counterpoints that you had and questions. It was is very good. But yeah, no, it's an interesting subject.
Yeah, I have a hunch that going forward, I mean, we're going to shoot to do this once a month. And I mean, at that point, it's 12 subjects a year, 6 from each of us. So we're not delving into a ton, but I would wager that this will come up as a rabbit trail pretty frequently. I think it's exceptionally relevant to our lives and the lives of the people in our generation, at least based off a lot of the current stats. I'm definitely excited to see how our opinions develop and change on that. And that's also part of it, right? Is, you know, having this recorded in 2019 means that we can look back in, you know, 5-10 years and see how we evolve and how we grow. It's part of this whole idea of starting with nothing and seeing where we go from here, starting from right. the ground up.
Yeah. No, it's going to be fascinating. I'm excited.
Me too, man. This was great. So we've established that you have no social media for people to find you on. Is there anywhere you want to point people or just the show social media?
You can add me at Real James King on Snapchat. That's about it. That's all I've got. Like I said, I may get back on eventually just for, you know, business. But for now, that's where to find me. So snap me.
Snap James. I am at Quentin Irie. Everywhere. Everything that I do is put on those social media channels. As of right now, there is no official social media for this show. And we haven't actually talked about this, so this is live. If the social media exists by the time this episode goes live, it'll be in the show notes. All my social media will be in the show notes. If you want to see what I'm up to with this show, with my website, book writing, movie writing, all that fun stuff, then you can definitely check that out there. Website is commoncandor.com. If you would like to / are willing to, this podcast will be available on iTunes, Spotify, pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts. Leaving a rating is extremely helpful. Lets other people find us and kind of grow our audience here. So definitely do that. 5 stars or over only.
That's right.
I think that's it. If there's nothing else, then we need a sign off. Shoot. Let's come up with a sign off real quick. This will be a good first episode thing. For the first podcast, I'm going to Google best radio sign offs. Do you think someone can sue us for stealing their sign off?
I don't know.
Okay. Top or famous TV sign offs. Good night and good luck. See you on the radio. Good night, Chet. Should we say good night, Chet, at the end of every episode? Good night, Chet. we could say good night if we do Patreon. I mean, it's going to take a little bit until we have patrons, but we could say good night to a different patron at the end of every episode.
Oh, yeah. Or we could do like Danny Gonzalez and have like a follow us next time and just like make up some random thing about what our next episode is going to be about. Like, see me next time to see me shrink down to the size of a bug and pilot a spacecraft across the continental U.S. Just like something like that.
Let me see if there's anything else good in here. And so it goes. Good night and good news.
I've had enough for one day.
And that's the way it is. That's kind of depressing. And that's the way it is. That's a part of our world. We're in touch, so you be in touch.
Dang, that's like a threat.
I really don't like most of those. I like the good night to a different person every time. So that means that in the meantime, we don't have anyone to say good night to.
Right. Except Chet.
Well, all right. Good night, Chet.
This concludes our broadcast day. Good night and God bless America.